Thanks for tuning in to PS Voice. In today's episode, we sit down with Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong and the Chancellor of the University of Oxford. Up for discussion today, Brexit, European populism, and Hong Kong 20 years after the handover. In this first section, we discuss Britain and Brexit.
So, Chris, can we go straight into the heat of the Brexit debate at the moment? All memoirs are full of anecdotes and witty observations, but unlike a lot of them, your book has got some quite deep thinking about the political trends that are going on in the world and in this country in particular. And one of the trends which is most common, which is maybe like a red thread that connects a lot of the memoir, is this theme of identity politics. To what extent do you think British politics is now identity politics?
I think it's lurched in that direction. At the same time as that's happened in Britain, we've seen, and not least thanks to President Macron and Angela Merkel, and indeed the Conservatives in the Netherlands, we've seen moves in the other direction. So I think there are some very good things going on. But what we've seen in Britain is the same sort of descent into nationalism, which is very different from patriotism, that has affected America. And I think that's happened for a number of reasons, one of which is the lack of any opposition to English nationalism on the part of the Conservative Party. I think this is very largely the result of a crisis within the Conservative Party. Let me say one thing about identity politics and what exactly I mean. People very often say about political science, as though there was such a thing, that the very first question is, who are we? And people like Samuel Huntington describe identity politics as a cultural clash or clash of nationalities, as though human rights weren't universal, as though people weren't much the same everywhere, although with different histories and traditions. We are a collection of I's, and each one of us is slightly different. And what I wanted to do was to approach this subject from my own point of view and point out how my own life and background and identity were a complex.
That's one of the most interesting things about the report, because you were part of a government with a prime minister who famously was the patron saint of the eye. She said there was no such thing as society. And when you talk about the Brexit result, you say that the main cause of it is the Conservative Party and that their attempts to try and blame Jeremy Corbyn, but that they're far-fetched. I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think Brexit is a consequence not just of two calamitous decisions made by British Conservative Prime Ministers, but I think is a consequence of failed attempts to manage the right wing of the Conservative Party. And this goes back to the 1990s. It goes back particularly to our having to leave the exchange rate mechanism. It goes back to the problems that John Major had and tried bravely to handle of managing the right wing of the Conservative Party, but some of them are unmanageable. They're dogmatic about these issues rather than believing in fact. I mean, they have faith. They have faith that you can replace our largest market with selling things to Australia. Or this or that Commonwealth country. I mean, it's all complete drivel.
The negotiations have just started, and we are talking about hard Brexit, soft Brexit. So do you think we could have a good Brexit?
Well, a good Brexit would be no Brexit. And when I say that, tabloid editors, I'm sure the Daily Mail and others, would say that shows I was a saboteur or an enemy of the people. When people say to me about the Brexit result, get over it, I'm not going to get over it. It was the worst thing to have happened politically in my lifetime. Worse in many respects than Suez, because Suez was the end of a period. This was an attempt to replace that colonial past with a real European future.
Do you think that it is now irreversible? Do you think the fact that Theresa May's been weakened so substantially means that that even the question about whether we leave the European Union might be open to question?
I think it's unfortunately very difficult to see that happening. But what I can imagine are circumstances in which through sensible diplomacy on the British side and the willingness for a change to take on the tabloids and the right-wing press, and with a certain generosity of spirit on the European Union side, we could arrive at what Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who is one of the few grown-ups in the government, describes as a slope rather than a cliff, a situation in which you have transitional arrangements, which take some recognition of the importance of Europe to us and of us to Europe. There are all sorts of things which are going to be affected, which will affect Europe as well. For example, the importance of our higher education and research sector in the European mix, which nobody's thought of any solutions to. So there are all sorts of things which I think should encourage other European countries, despite the fact that we're so tiresome, to behave well to us, provided we behave well to them.
And now, populism and Europe.
I just want to ask the question about Macron, Emmanuel Macron. Do you think that the fact that we have Emmanuel Macron in France right now, just at that particular time, it's a good thing?
I think it's a great thing, because it gives people who believe in the political process and in the importance of democracy, for the first time, some real reason for feeling encouraged. He was, of course, people will say he was lucky, but he was also extremely brave. And the sort of things he says about the way the world works, I can't imagine myself disagreeing with 1% of them. Decent, civilized, extremely well-educated, and with wonderful diplomatic manners. That visit that Mrs. May was invited to make just after the election was his idea. He behaved impeccably to her. He didn't patronize somebody who had just had a terrible beating up by the electorate's hands. I'm a commandeur of the Légion d'honneur. I love France. I'm a genuine Francophile. So I know some of the problems that he faces, but I think it's in all our interests that he overcomes them, and he's more likely to overcome them than anybody else I can think of.
But there's French problems, but they're kind of wider European problems, and in a way the Macron-Merkel axis symbolises the great new hope for the EU.
Yeah, but
do you think it can work?
Well, it can work, I think, if Angela Merkel listens to President Macron rather than Finance Minister Schäuble. I think that
You point out in your book that debt in German, Schulden, is the same word as guilt.
Yes.
Which is also links up with your general slightly religious framing of the...
I'm not religious about economic policy, I can tell you. But I think...
Do you think that that there is any chance that Merkel's actually going to grant fiscal and transfer union that Macron needs and to get rid of Schäuble?
No, not to get rid of Schäuble, but what the Germans have to do is to be a little more flexible. And they have to be more flexible about issues like issuing a European bond. The Greeks are in a position which is impossible. They can't possibly dig themselves out of the hole they're in unless they have debt relief. And if the Greeks can't do it now, how are we going to deal with the Italians before very long? So I'm not suggesting that you should abandon any notion of fiscal rectitude. I'm not saying that you should take on the populist press in Germany by saying, well, the Greeks can retire 10 years younger than you and get bigger benefits and we'll go on bailing them out from that. I'm not saying any of that. What I'm saying is that it should be possible to be more flexible in the way that the Eurozone is managed. And I think President Macron should be able to convince Angela Merkel of that, because otherwise you'll continue to have a position in which the Germans are blamed in Southern Europe unfairly, to some extent, for everything that goes wrong.
Macron is here, is like a hope for some people like you, but the roots of populism are still there. So how can you address this kind of problems? I mean, migration,
well, one thing that Macron clearly wants to do is to make the labour market more flexible. France should be a lot richer than it is because French productivity is so high. France produces by Thursday evening what we take until Friday evening to produce. Now, it does so with a labour market which is incredibly inflexible. So it doesn't create as many jobs as it should, so that people in rundown areas don't get the employment opportunities which one would like to see them getting in, for example, the northwest of France. And who gets blamed for that? Globalization gets blamed for that, and immigrants get blamed for that. The real immigration problem for Europe hasn't happened yet. Over the first half of this century, we'll see the population of Africa increasing from 1 billion to 2.5 billion. In states, many of which have failed, in states which not only export their problems environmentally, but their people. And unless we actually address that issue now, the present rumpus about immigration will be as nothing in comparison with what people are worrying about them.
And finally, Hong Kong and China.
One of the big themes in the book is Hong Kong and China and your role as the last governor of Hong Kong. You say in the book that you thought that the steady introduction of democracy would guarantee Hong Kong's future freedom. How confident do you feel about that with Xi Jinping in power now?
Well,
that well-known Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, the people who said that democracy was going to save Hong Kong from a squeeze after 1997 were, of course, the government after the Joint Declaration. You look at the speeches made in the House of Commons, and when people, remember George Robertson, the man who went on to be NATO Secretary General, making a speech about this, how can you guarantee that Hong Kong's freedoms, Hong Kong's autonomy will last beyond 1997? And he was told it was because we were going to develop democracy there. And then we went slow on that. I was attacked for the small changes I made, all of which were within what had been agreed with China. I was congratulated as I was Thomas Paine or Danton. Actually, what I did was simply try to make elections free and fair. So we didn't do as much as we should have done. And now it's not only a question of the Chinese having choked off any further democratic development, but they've been attacking the rule of law. They've intervened in judicial cases in Hong Kong. They've abducted people from Hong Kong streets. There's been a steady throttling of the freedom of the press. And all those aspects of the sort of software of democracy, which have been so important in Hong Kong, they've found very uncomfortable.
So 20 years after the handover, does Britain have any responsibility towards the Democrats there?
Well, we have a legal responsibility and a moral responsibility, and the rest of the world has a political interest. Let me explain. Our legal and moral responsibilities are because the Joint Declaration, the guarantees to Hong Kong, are set out in an international treaty lodged at the United Nations, which should guarantee Hong Kong's autonomy and way of life until 2047. Treaty. And as international lawyers would say, pacta sunt servanda. It's there. We had certain obligations to the people of Hong Kong before 1997, which we told the Chinese we would honour. They have obligations to the people of Hong Kong after 1997, which they have to explain to us that they're, and the rest of the world, that they're honouring. They behave as though the Joint Declaration didn't exist, as though it was a Chinese declaration. It's an international treaty. So we should be honour-bound and legally bound to point out when they, in the spirit or the letter, breach that. But the interest for other people is a very simple one. China is going to play, no doubt about it, a big and significant role in the 21st century. When we reach agreements with China, will they keep them? When I negotiated with China, people used to say, oh, well, it's very difficult to negotiate with them, but at least they keep their word.
Yeah.
That is, frankly, faith-based, not fact-based.
Absolutely, because, I mean, we've just seen in Hong Kong that the government the Chinese government managed to resist the so-called umbrella revolution. They've now appointed a chief executive. I mean, is there anything that the rest of the world can do?
You can see it even beyond that. I mean, I was part of the negotiating team with Pascal Lamy for China's WTO access. The obligations that they made, that they undertook in order to become members of the WTO, they've slithered away from, so that they have access to our markets in terms of goods, in terms of investment, without giving us the same access to theirs.
So how can
on that point, President Trump is absolutely right.
So do you think that's the way to deal with it? I mean, how what can the rest
of the
world do?
I don't think anybody is dealing with it.
But what could they do, given the speed of Chinese growth, the size of the economy, the self-confidence which they have, the way that they're changing geopolitics in every single part of the world because of their economic presence?
Well, then, it's a rum way of showing that you're self-confident to lock up anybody who ever offers a word of criticism. It's an odd way to show your self-confident by banning yellow umbrellas in Beijing because they were the symbol of these kids were using, these very brave young men and women were using in Hong Kong. I think the extraordinary thing about China is that despite its very welcome economic development, despite its huge economic growth in the last few years, it doesn't have a very large global footprint. Who are China's friends around the world?
There's North Korea, Pakistan.
Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and occasionally a country where they've sunk so much money that it feels it has to go along with them, like Greece recently. So I'm not awfully convinced that the future lies only with China. I think China has to work with others, and we have to be in a position where we can believe what they say.
So Hong Kong could be a test to see if China is a responsible superpower.
That's exactly my view. Hong Kong should be a test not only of China's ability to keep its word and willingness to keep its word, but also goes right to the heart of lots of issues which matter enormously to the world in the 21st century. How much should a sense of human rights play a role in foreign policy? What's the relationship between economic freedom and political freedom? All those and other issues very much the sort of things which will be determined in a place like Hong Kong.
So in the book, you say whether the arrival of a Trump presidency will smooth Chinese diplomacy at the edges will be a defining issue in international affairs. One needs to be an optimist to think that President Trump and President Xi will bring out the best in each other. What do you fear is actually going to happen?
Well, what I fear, at least for a time, is that they both behave like, sorry to, this is going to sound a bit academic, they both behave like Athens in the Peloponnesian War. You may remember in Thucydides' brilliant account, he talks about the Athenian delegation which goes to a very small state called Melos. And tells the Melians that they've got to join up with Athens, otherwise they're in big trouble. And the Melians say, but we don't want to. We don't want to take part in the war. And the Melians and the Athenians say to them, just get real. In this world, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. And that's a world that in the second half of the last century, we put behind us.
Yeah.
But that's the world which I'm afraid both President Xi and President Trump seem to represent.
Okay, I've got one final question to you about the title of your book. You've called it First Confession. And I don't know that you have many political sins to atone for, but if there's one thing that you would do differently again, what would it be?
Oh, I know exactly what it would be. And it's a very personal thing, it's not a political thing. I got into university very early. When I was 16, I got a small scholarship to Oxford. And I had the opportunity of leaving school at 16 and having a year and a half before I went to university. And instead of taking that and going off and learning to speak French better than I do, or learning to speak Italian, or learning to speak German, going around the world, I stayed on at school in order to be captain of everything. And I think the only time when you really have the freedom and liberty to learn about another language or learn another culture is when you're young, because you never have the time later on to do it. So my biggest regret is that I was captain of the school cricket team.
So that's almost as minor as Tony Blair, who in his long memoir looks back and for things that he regretted, and he kind of casts over the Iraq war and other things and says that he regretted banning fox hunting and freedom of information. If you had to choose a political thing that you really regret or that you'd do differently now, what would it be?
Well, I suppose it would be that I spent so long when I was governor of Hong Kong trying to negotiate the things which the Chinese were never going to agree on. There are some things which I've been pleased to take a stand on, like the issues that we had to resolve when I was chairman of the Commission on Policing in Northern Ireland. One thing which was unfortunate wasn't really my own fault. I was promoted to the cabinet to be Secretary of State for the Environment the year the poll tax came in. So I was landed with the responsibility for the most unpopular thing that's ever happened in this country since the Black Death. And that was a sort of hospital pass, as rugby players would say. So that was unfortunate. It wasn't really my fault, though.
Okay, well, Lord Patton, François Bougon, thank you very much. And thank you for watching PS On Air. I hope that you enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to PS Voice. Go beyond the news with Project Syndicate by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and by reading our greatest minds at www.project-syndicate.org.